And good morning. It's Monday, January 4th, and you're listening to KGNU's Morning Magazine. I'm Roz Brown. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up today on the magazine, electoral votes for President-elect Joe Biden will be challenged on Wednesday when Congress meets to certify the presidential election results. We'll hear from one political expert who contends it will only delay, not change the outcome for Biden, and is instead a symbolic move to show support for President Donald Trump. Then we'll check the temperature of local politics with Boulder Beat reporter Shay Castle as we head into a new season of Boulder City Council meetings. The Tiny Homes for Homeless Veterans project coming together in Longmont will be the topic of a virtual presentation this week. We'll hear more about the unique approach coming up. Then, as part of our ongoing collaboration reporting on the impacts of fossil fuels, a project coordinated by the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Coalition, we learn about the challenge of one electrical utility cooperative that they're facing as it shifts toward increased renewable energy. And we'll get a preview of this afternoon's Metro Show, which airs at 3 p.m. on KGNU, when Miriam Schiff interviews Teresa Strader, founder and CEO of the National Mill Dog Rescue. At 8:30, Frank Dabosky will be in. He's the host this morning at Public Affairs Program with his guest Lee Shanus, Executive Director of Intercambio, a Boulder-based nonprofit that provides cultural integration and English language classes to immigrants. They'll discuss how Intercambio adapted their programs to the challenges of the pandemic. And stay tuned at 9 o'clock for Counterspin, and then at 9:30 for another morning of eclectic music until noon here at KGNU. But first, a look at headlines with KGNU's Jamie Sudler.
Today, all of the 33 counties that have been in level red on the state's COVID-19 dial will move back down to orange. Under level orange, restaurants can allow customers back inside. Capacity limits will be capped at 25% or 50 people. Denver, along with the rest of the Front Range, will be allowed to take small steps back toward normal. Governor Jared Polis made the announcement on Twitter last week. Davin Heldon, owner of Liquid Mechanics Brewing Company in Lafayette, told KDVR that it was a pleasant surprise to hear that they could go to level orange. Heldon had made investments in expanding the restaurant's indoor tap room, and now with the move to level orange, he's hoping it will pay off by allowing the brewery to have 20 tables instead of the 9 they had before. In Boulder County, the health department reported Sunday that there were 107 new coronavirus cases, but no new deaths. The rate of new cases among Boulder County residents in the past 2 weeks is about 334 per 100,000. Hundreds of protesters were arrested last summer during demonstrations in Aurora over the battle for racial justice. Two of them, Joel Northam and Lillian House, now face felony charges. Next week, there will be preliminary hearings in their cases, the first step in court prosecutions against them. Northam told 9 News that the charges are not just an attack on him and House as organizers and on their organization, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, but an attack on a mass movement of thousands of people, families, and community members. Both House and Northam became well-known leaders of the protests in the fight for justice for Elijah McClain, who died at the hands of Aurora police and first responders, and brought thousands into the streets week after week last summer. Very few of the protesters faced charges as serious as Northam and House, half of which are felonies. If convicted, House said she could be sentenced up to 48 years in prison. The most serious charges include engaging in a riot without a weapon, inciting a riot with damage, and attempted kidnapping of an entire precinct of officers in the Aurora Police Department. The Adams County District Attorney's Office alleges those charged with kidnapping attempted to imprison 18 officers. House and Northam said that they were unexpectedly arrested several months after the June and July protests. Both say that while they value their freedom from prison, they say this fight is for everyone's freedom to protest. Thousands of unemployed Coloradans jammed the state's unemployment website yesterday as they followed mistaken instructions to request payments. The Colorado Sun reports that many found themselves stymied by a system that would not let them log in or by a note telling them they weren't allowed to request a payment. By late morning, the system was overwhelmed with many users complaining they could not get through. A spokesperson for the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment said the mix-up was because of an email that erroneously instructed recipients to file for weekly payments yesterday. 500,000 people were sent the email, reminding them that they were required to make a request before the state put all claims on pause in order to move everyone to an upgraded computer system. But not everyone was eligible to make a request on Sunday. The email had nothing to do with the end of the extended pandemic benefits or the start of new federal benefits. An upgraded computer system is expected to be available on January 10th. Colorado's prison population has dropped significantly this year, but state analysts expect it will start trending back upward again soon. There are two main reasons for the population falling: the release of prisoners deemed to be low risk, and a recent law that reduced penalties on drug possession charges. The Denver Post reports that after peaking at 23,000 in 2009, the state prison population has steadily dropped to about 20,000 in recent years. But since February, it's down even 4,000 more. A state spokesperson said they expect the population to tick back upward after next year because there will be fewer prisoners deemed low risk, since many have already been released in an effort to contain the coronavirus, which has ravaged the prison system. Colorado State Parks recorded a nearly 23% increase in visitors in 2020, even as data from November and December is still yet to be logged. The Gazette reports that the increase comes even despite some closures due to the pandemic and price hikes at some parks. At Castlewood Canyon State Park near Castle Rock, visitation was up by more than 50% from what was a record year in 2017. Lake Pueblo recorded the most visitors, with a record of almost 3 million from January through October. The state's other most popular parks were Chatfield and Cherry Creek. Today's weather will see mostly sunny skies with the highs in the low 50s. Tomorrow, there's a slight chance of rain showers in the late morning and possibly turning to snow in the early afternoon. Otherwise, partly cloudy with the high in the upper 40s. Sunny skies return on Wednesday. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It's 8:11 here at KGNU. The presidential drama will continue this week when the members of both the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate are expected to challenge the results of November's election. A dozen Republican senators and senators-elect announced Saturday they will vote against counting electoral votes on Wednesday when Congress is expected to certify President-elect Joe Biden's victory, despite no credible evidence suggesting widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election. Earlier, at least 100 House Republicans also said they will vote against counting the Electoral College votes on Congress. Political experts contend the effort will only delay the process and say it's intended to serve as a symbolic move to show support for President Donald Trump. Political journalist Robert Yoon believes it's a long shot.
Because the Democrats control the House, it's pretty much dead on arrival. I think it's more of a symbolic gesture to show the president and the president's supporters that something is being done to challenge these results.
Vice President Mike Pence is also facing pressure to take a last stand on Trump's behalf. A group of Republicans is arguing that the VP has the constitutional power to accept or reject the presidential election results from any state he chooses. A federal judge on Friday dismissed a lawsuit that sought to empower Pence to unilaterally decide the 2020 election results rather than have Congress count the electoral votes. Pence and the Department of Justice had urged the court to reject the lawsuit, but over the weekend, Pence said he welcomes an effort by lawmakers to raise objections on Wednesday. Yoon says Pence is in an awkward position.
Other than declaring that the votes in each state are valid or not, he doesn't have much leeway to call for an investigation. But some of the president's supporters are calling on Pence to try to blow up the process anyway by refusing to take action when the time comes. That would be unprecedented.
Yoon notes that members of Congress challenged the electoral results in 1969 and 2005, and the only result was a temporary delay in the process. You're listening to KGNU's Morning Magazine. Shay Castle is the owner and publisher of Boulder Beat News, where she covers local government and politics. Every couple of weeks, she shares what's happening with issues before the Boulder City Council. Here's my conversation with Shay Castle. Shay, the city of Boulder put out a press release at the end of the year about how many people who are experiencing homelessness they were able to house this year. Tell us about that. You wrote about that on your website. So tell us about that. And I also know you attended the ceremony at Bandshell earlier this month to commemorate the lives of the homeless folks that we lost in our community this year. So let's start there.
So the city of Boulder has and been employing a new strategy for homelessness for the past 3 years. And over that time, they've managed to place 1,000 individuals into permanent housing. And that was announced at the end of this year, as you said. So that's obviously a huge number. We really don't know how many people were placed into housing before the Housing First approach, but it's likely it was nowhere near that amount. Data tracking was very poor. At the same time, critics of the Housing First strategy have noted that, number one, we don't know how many people have stayed in housing who are housed. One of the men who died outside this year in the September snowstorm, John Aldridge, the Boulder shelter director Greg Harms told me he had been in permanent housing before, and somehow, I still don't know how, ended up losing that housing and back on the street where he unfortunately died. So there are still some things to be worked out in the system, but obviously it's a big milestone to have housed 1,000 people.
So did they commemorate John Aldridge at the ceremony at the Banshell this year?
They did. John Aldridge was one of 50 names who that was read out at the homeless memorial at the Banshell this year. He wasn't referenced specifically. They read out all of the names, and then people who knew these individuals were invited to share, and there were a few things shared about a couple of the people. But as I found in my research, it's very difficult to find information on a lot of these individuals. Some of them, there's absolutely no record of them. Some of them, there's only jail logs for when they've been arrested. One of the women, she was arrested for littering, and that's literally the only thing I could find on her. That is a very high number of people who've died this year. Last year was the highest, and that was 48 people. So this year is even higher. I'm still looking into why that is, why more people have died this year than is typical and than last year. Just as a clarification, not all of these people were homeless at the time of their deaths. Some were housed, but as Scott Medina from Bridge House noted, homelessness takes a great toll on individuals and it can take up to 30 years off of your life. So it is considered a factor in their deaths, whether they were housed at the time of their deaths or not.
All right. Thank you, Shay. This week, we have a regular city council meeting tomorrow night, and I see that the thorny issue of the CU South Boulder campus is on the agenda. Tell us what we can expect from that.
So this is really just kind of an asterisk, the South Boulder Creek flood mitigation issue. So council in June finally settled on a flood design for, you know, what the detention area, the flood wall, and the dam will look like. But at the time, the Open Space Board of Trustees asked that they be allowed to analyze, again, an option to detain more water further upstream along South Boulder Creek. And this is an option that's been looked at twice before, 2015 and 2018. It was rejected both times by staff, but residents continue to push for it. And council felt it deserved another analysis. So that has been done. Staff did an analysis along with an advisory group that they put together. The Open Space Board and the Water Resources Advisory Board and Planning Board all had representatives on that. And then the Open Space Board looked again at upstream analysis and recommended against it, which followed with staff's analysis. So City Council will be getting an update on that. I don't believe they'll be voting or anything. It's just kind of a, hey, we did one last due diligence check-in on this, and the flood design that we picked in June stands as what we're going forward with.
All right. Is there anything else on the agenda that our listeners might be interested in?
Absolutely. Some listeners might remember that the public hearing and vote on the Macy's redevelopment was rescheduled from December to this meeting, and that's the public hearing for the evening. This is Macy's plans to adaptively reuse the retail space there into office space and then a little marketplace. And as part of that, they're adding on a partial addition, which will take the building from two stories to three in a part. It's kind of tricky because one of the stories is actually underground. They're going to daylight a little bit of that basement area, do some public plaza renovations. But obviously, anytime there's a building that goes up to city's building height limit of 55 feet, that draws a fair amount of interest from the public.
What are you looking forward to, or what are you dreading as far as council agenda items for the rest of 2021?
Well, speaking of CU South, in the middle of the year, we're supposed to have a public hearing and council decision on annexation of the university's land into the city. The first big part of that was settling on the flood design. Now we need to actually add the university's land into the city to be able to build that. And that, I think, will be a really big issue. We have the racial equity plan coming up in February, and we got our preview in December. I don't know how well that will go. And the prairie dogs, I believe the lethal control plan is due for a check-in, although I could be wrong. And then just the perennial issues of Boulder, you know, transportation and growth and development. And these things are never easy, but they are like I said, perennial. So that's what we have to look forward to this year. And that will be on top of ongoing budget concerns due to COVID.
Right. I mean, we had no idea some of these policing issues were going to come up again this year with the Black Lives Matter. So you're right. I mean, some things could come up that are completely unexpected.
That's what keeps it fun.
All right. Thank you so much, Shay.
Again, that was journalist Shay Castle, owner and publisher of Boulder Beat News, where she covers local government and politics. And you can find more of her work at boulderbeat.news. It's 8:19. This Thursday, the Veterans Community Project will share information about its tiny home village in Longmont for veterans experiencing homelessness. It's only the second of its kind for the group after the first opened in Kansas City in 2018. The site in southwest Longmont will accommodate 26 new tiny homes, 2 to 300 square feet, and a community center. Navy veteran Paul Melrow with the nonprofit Veterans Project participated in KGNU's Unhoused radio series and noted that veterans are disproportionately reflected in unhoused populations across the country.
The nuance with us is that if you're coming into that housing program, you are going to get wraparound services. We're going to address the things that got you into the homeless situation to begin with, whether it's mental health issues, physical health, job training, financial literacy. The housing is strictly transitional, so we don't charge rent or utilities or anything. It's free to the vet who gets to stay there, but they have to be a willing participant in getting those services. What my concern would be is that if you throw people that are having housing issues into housing without necessarily addressing the underlying causes of the problems they're having, the success is just going to be limited. I don't want to pretend that maybe that's okay for a segment of the homeless population. This is a problem that we have spent decades trying to grapple with, somewhat unsuccessfully, as a nation. But we are starting to get clever about how to work with certain segments of that population. The solutions are daunting. There's no cookie cutter solution to any of this, and you have to be willing to sort of attack things from a lot of different angles.
Again, that was Paul Melroy with the Veterans Community Project. This Thursday, the WebEx about the Tiny Homes Project in Longmont is from 7 to 8 o'clock, but registration is limited to the first 100 people. That's in the evening, 7 to 8 p.m. Contact the Longmont Public Library if you'd like to learn more and if you'd like to hear the entire series KGNU produced called Unhoused. Go to news.kgnu.org. The electrical utility cooperative that provides power to many rural areas of Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, and Nebraska is called Tri-State Generation and Transmission Association. And like others, the co-op has relied on coal and fossil fuels to generate the bulk of its power for many years. Now, Tri-State is beginning a rapid shift towards increasing renewable energy. But as Austin Cope of KSJD reports, undoing years of fossil fuel influence may be challenging.
When Tri-State Generation and Transmission Association unveiled its Responsible Energy Plan at the beginning of 2020, it released a video showing colorful footage of solar panels and wind turbines in a grassy field.
We are taking bold steps to change how your energy is produced. With 50% of your electricity coming from renewable sources by 2024. Because as a cooperative, we are changing together.
The specifics of this plan are being submitted to Colorado regulators this winter in a document called an Electric Resource Plan, or ERP. Right now, Tri-State still gets two-thirds of its energy from fossil fuel sources. As late as 2016, that amount was over three-quarters.
The hallmark of the Electric Resource Plan filing and our preferred scenario is the identification of an additional 1,850 megawatts of renewable energy and energy storage that we believe we'll need to install by 2030.
That's Tri-State's Vice President of Communications, Lee Bowie. He says among other benchmarks, the co-op is on track to meet an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions in Colorado by 2030. It will also close all of its fossil fuel plants in Colorado by the end of the decade. He says its plans show a commitment to providing, quote, reliable and responsible energy to its members.
Well, I do know they're committed because there's a state mandate that requires them to be committed.
That's Jessica Matlock, CEO of La Plata Electric Association in southwestern Colorado. She's referring to legislation passed in 2019 that requires utilities in Colorado to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions to 80% of 2005 levels by 2030. This legislation is a bigger influence on Tri-State's creation of the Responsible Energy Plan than the utility's commitment to fighting climate change, Matlock says. The cooperative has had a historic culture of viewing fossil fuels as superior to renewable energy, she adds, and that view stretches back a long time. As an example, she recalls working as a staffer on a U.S. Senate Energy Committee in the mid-2000s, where Tri-State would come to lobby alongside fossil fuel investors in support of pro-coal legislation.
This was an electric cooperative utility, a public power entity that was advocating, the only one in the U.S. advocating to keep their coal.
The process to create Tri-State's Responsible Energy Plan didn't start until 2019, after the legislation was passed and after two of Tri-State's main competitors had released their own versions of renewable energy expansion plans. Bowie acknowledges some skepticism about the transition towards renewables among some of Tri-State's 42 member co-ops. But he says the steps the utility has taken with the REP shows that solar, wind, and hydropower can be reliable and cost competitive with coal and natural gas. Formerly resistant members are coming around to the changes, he says. But other co-op members think the transition is moving too slowly. La Plata Electric and another member are negotiating to exit or modify their Tri-State contracts, and two others have already left the co-op. Details are still being worked out in court, but the move stem in part from Tri-State's contract restrictions on the amount of renewable energy the local cooperatives have been allowed to generate. For example, Delta Montrose Electric Association in Western Colorado finalized its exit in the summer of 2020. It cited the high prices of fossil fuels and Tri-State's reluctance to add more renewables to its grid in its decision to do so. Another provider in New Mexico followed a similar track several years previously. Other parts of the Responsible Energy Plan also need improvement, according to Gwen Farnsworth, Senior Energy Policy Advisor at the environmental policy group Western Resource Advocates. While the plan will reduce greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels, it doesn't account for emissions from sources outside of Colorado. Specifically, Farnsworth notes Tri-State still has a contract to buy power from a large coal power plant in Wyoming.
So I think that's going to be one of the big challenges, is figuring out how Tri-State can meet its goals for emissions reductions, for renewable energy, and for cost reductions for their customers in Colorado while they are tied to a contract with an out-of-state generation that is high cost and high emissions.
While Tri-State is considering a plan to stop buying power from that station by 2033, Bowie says it has not made a final commitment and won't for some time.
We have to work with the other owners of those power plants as we look at the future and what role they play in the electric system.
This winter, as Tri-State submits documents about the plan, Colorado regulators will have the chance to require changes, clarifications, and additions. So now, with 2019's legislation, the state of Colorado will get to decide whether Tri-State's Responsible Energy Plan is really responsible enough. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio and KSJD, I'm Austin Cope.
And thanks to Austin Cope for that report, part of our ongoing collaboration, reporting on the impacts of fossil fuels in conjunction with Rocky Mountain Community Radio Coalition. It's 8:27.
Where are we going in 2021? On the next Alternative Radio, hear Kali Akuno and Richard Wolff on capitalism, the pandemic, and the two-party monopoly. That's Alternative Radio, Wednesday evenings at 6, right here on Community Radio, KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins.
This afternoon at 3 o'clock on KGNU's Metro program, host Miriam Schiff talks to Teresa Strader. Teresa Strader is the founder and CEO of National Mill Dog Rescue. And here's a preview of that show coming up this afternoon.
You have rescued over 16,000 dogs since
15,600 and some.
Since 2007. Dog rescuers, any rescuer, is not met with an open door and people are going to say, oh, come right in, we'll have tea together. How do you find out about them and hear about them? And what is it like when you go in?
Great question, by the way, because a lot of people don't understand how this works. Some people, I think we're like rescue ninjas and we show up in the middle of the night and free all the dogs. And obviously, that's not the way it is. That would not be legal. So early on, one, we didn't have a bunch of money to go to dog auctions and buy rescue And there's a lot of controversy around people that do that, groups that do that. I make no judgment. I'm happy for every dog that gets out of a bad situation and into a good one. But for us, that just organizationally, that's not how it works. We get the dogs directly from the breeders. So, and that has not been an easy thing to build. You know, the early years, a lot of these people were very suspect of us. You know, we're trying to put them out of business. And the truth is, you know, even just 10 years ago, a lot of them needed to be out of business.
And again, that's Teresa Strader. She's the founder and CEO of National Mill Dog Rescue. She'll have her full story this afternoon on KGNU's Metro program with Miriam Schiff. That's at 3 o'clock. If you're interested in applying for a 2021 Boulder Arts Commission cultural grant, there's an informational session this Wednesday, January 13th at 4 p.m. on Zoom. The session will include a conversation with an arts commissioner to answer questions about their decision-making process. Organizations or individuals who plan to apply for grants this year can learn more about these sessions and the grants program by visiting the website boulderarts.com. Information on the 2021 grant program is now available. RSVP to click L at boulderlibrary.org. New applications are available for community projects, art education projects, and professional development scholarships. Organizations, individuals, and classrooms are encouraged to apply again. That is the 2021 Boulder Arts Commission Cultural Grant Program, and that informational session is this Wednesday at 4 p.m. on Zoom. We were looking for a high temperature around 50 degrees today and mostly sunny skies, low tonight around 35, and then we will have maybe some rain, maybe some snow later in the week, according to Jamie Sudler. Apparently, I told you that wrong earlier, that there was no snow in the forecast. So an update is always good, as Colorado's weather is always changing.